All right, so I was going to give a little, I mean, it's always dangerous to say that in 45 minutes you're going to give background material because it's salaciously biased. But Misha Ahrens, who's been studying large-scale activity, which means recording for the majority of neurons in zebra fishery, and Misha and I just were sort of very interested in sort of issues that were posed both theoretically and experimentally. So from a theoretical sense, neurons throughout the nervous system are in contact on all length scales. I mean, you don't just have neurons in a little cortical column or in a little ganglia that are active. I mean, basically the entire brain becomes active at once. And I mean, this was actually pointed out by the sort of great anatomist Kevin Martin very many years ago in response to this very feed-forward picture that was put out by David Van Essen, that you sort of had this choo-choo train model of the nervous system where information kind of flowed through. And by the time it got to the backside of the nervous system, you'd already made a decision. And in a sense, all the neurons are active at once. So this poses theoretical challenge to understand how you could compute in this manner. And it also, poses an experimental challenge to ask how much can you record at once and maybe how much should you record at once. So I took a very biased slice through people's data to sort of illustrate these points, and both from the organizational perspective, from the perspective of connectivity among neurons. And then because it's a mixed audience, I also took a sort of slice out of sort of, you might say, modern experimental techniques just to sort of get everybody up to speed. And I apologize in places because I grabbed a number of things from my own lab only because it was Saturday and time was running out and I had to get the talk together. So it's somewhat embarrassing bias. It's very fashionable to, in neuroscience talks today, you see a picture of a neuron and a quote from Cajal. So I mean, I'll show you more modern pictures of neurons, but I thought this was kind of interesting. About 110 years out from when this remark was made. Okay, so just the one thing that came from Cajal, just to remind everybody, was a neuron doctrine. It was the idea that the nervous system is actually made up of components, that it's not a large syssystem where everybody's interacting with each other. And within this, I mean, this is a single neuron, these very fine processes, which you can't quite make out in the resolution on the screen, are the synaptic contacts. You can think of these as the field effect transistors between the output of one cell and the input of another cell. It's directed communication. It uses about the same energetics as a modern field effect transistor, about one picojoule per transition. I think Bobby Kasturi, three years ago now, in Jeff Hookman's lab, really worked at the details of this very beautifully. Each of these processes coming in as an axon from another cell, and they're making a synapse onto this postsynaptic cell. So somewhat different than electronics, where you have fans in, which are mentioned in, a few or 10. You have fan in coming to cells, which is the order of something like 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4. And from a theoretical perspective, this poses the question, is everybody on the order of the same strength? And we'll get back to this later. Or are there a few particularly strong connections in a sea of weaker connections, okay, which maybe serve sort of a role of plasticity so that you could actually tune your inputs? Okay. All right, so again, we have a bias in the workshop. There's many flavors of nervous systems. There are nerve nets that were first studied from our former UCSD colleague, Ted Bullock, in which if you excite a little edge of this net, an excitation spreads and the bell kind of contracts and the little jellyfish sort of slowly pushes itself away. I mean, it's the same nerve net actually you see in corals. Ted was very clever, and the way he actually measured these things was to have a TV camera looking at all the little polyp on corals, and every time one neuron would fire, a little polyp would move to the side. Okay, it was, I think, the first publication on imaging in neuroscience. Cilentrics, are back in the news. They're back in the news in part because from an evolution point of view, most of the evolution takes place by editing of RNA, which is very different than what happens in us. Cilantras have a very distributed nervous system, many ganglia, as opposed to what will be the plan for the vertebrate nervous system. So we are completely ignoring this part of the world, okay? And what we're going to focus on is what's called the vertebrate nervous plan. And this was Harvey Karton many years ago, and Walling Nauta made what they called the SHMU diagram of the vertebrate nervous plan. And this seems to be the nervous plan that nature has sort of fixated on, okay, in regard to all vertebrates. And it's not obvious why this has to be. And it really is sort of a sense of a hierarchy. I mean, this is this entire region is the cortical mantle. The way in which this diagram was made was by taking structures and parking them next to other structures for which they have the most number of connections. Okay, so I'll get back to this in a slightly functional sense. But this is somatosensory cortex. This is olfactory cortex. These are regions in which the animal is actually doing near field sensing, which are highly connected. This region is,
But you're talking about cortex?
Okay. So this is forebrain, midbrain, hindbrain.
Yeah, so this is more correct.
Spinal cord. Yeah.
So there's no real cortex. Homolog cortex, can you elaborate on
that? Well, no, this is a general, because it's a fish?
Not mammalian, so vertebrate nervous plan.
Yeah, did I say mammalian? Oh, that was a Freudian slip. Who's a mammal? Okay. I'm sorry. Forebrain. Okay. So there is a point. It's a little off target, but the sequence of connections, like the sequence of connections you're used to thinking of cortex of layer 4 to layer 2, 3 to layer 5. That's one of the most famous, the dominant, but not the only. Processing sequence actually is, our colleague Harvey Karton pointed out this sequence is seen in birds, and then Felnick Cliff Bragsdale recently showed using a number of genetic markers that this is very preserved. It's preserved in fish, it's preserved in bird brains. So there seems to be this...
Who did this in fish?
Cliff Bragsdale at University of Chicago. There was a penis paper about three years ago. It was sort of the vindication of Harvey's anatomical studies. Yeah. Okay. So the point I want to make is a sort of overall structure of forebrain areas that at least in this sense, in terms of maximal connectivity, seems to have something to do with far field versus near field sensation. And then you get a sense of flow. And so the signaling flow is through spinal cord or through hindbrain, sensory input coming into hindbrain, going through midbrain areas. This is thalamic areas. There's no way to read this from the distance, flowing up to cortex, and then reversing and flowing back down to hindbrain areas, particularly for olfacial control, or to spinal areas for locomotion or feeding. Okay. Now, within this, I want to pursue this a little bit. The most studied region in the brain, the most studied brain as far as anatomy goes, is the rat, okay? And consistent with sort of the fascination of neuroscientists with cortex, okay? The greatest number of labeling studies and of studies of projections have been done in the rat cortex, okay? So there were some 14,000 papers written on projections within the rat cortex. And Larry Swanson and his colleagues, Botta and Sporns, who coined the term connectome based on fMRI data, went through every paper, scored them in a kind of qualitative way to whether they actually believed what they saw based on the technique that was used at the time. I mean, these are modern days. We use viruses to jump from one cell to the next. I mean, these have their own biases. There's a certain amount of tropism, so there's a bias that way. Many years ago, people would damage an axon, and you'd watch degeneration takes place and use that as a measure. So there's a little bit of a qualitative nature to how you score these experiments. But at the end of the day, they accepted around 1/3 of the papers. And at the end of the day, Larry Swanson, who's at USC, so the dean, you might say, of mammalian anatomists, had identified some 500-ish different brain areas, okay, based on cytoarchitectural issues. And they found that there was good literature on about 70 connections between about 77 of these areas, right? So not so much, maybe 15% of what they saw. And within those 77-ish areas, okay, there was good data to go to for about half the possible connections. So you can think of a matrix, right? So of a 77 by 77 matrix, you could fill in, you know, about half of the NN minus 1 over 2 connections. Okay, so this looks like a seeing R chart, but now, in fact, we get back to the picture I showed before, and I thought this was very interesting. So once you fill in this connectivity matrix, and then you do clustering in this matrix. That how they did it is not so terribly important. Just clustering on connection strength. Just they looked at the graph Laplacian, and this sort of justified this qualitative picture that Larry had come up with, because what's called M1, M2, M3, M4 are the dominant modes of this matrix. And you have a dominant mode, which means that there are particularly strong connections between somatotopic regions and motor regions. Okay? And then you have each mode has a weaker connection, has stronger connections within the mode than between modes. You have a second mode, which is called, which is M1, which is mostly auditory regions, visual regions, no motor regions. You have another mode, which is M3, which in some crude sense you would say is something to do with memory and high order processing, which is including hippocampus, entorhinal cortex, and mode 4 is mostly mostly olfactory system. Okay, so in some sense, there's a clustering already that takes place based on a meta-analysis of all the known anatomy. So I think it's important to keep this in mind. I think it was important to say that somehow nature doesn't necessarily pick out one particular sensory input, but it picks out sensation in sort of an ethologically relevant way, nearby versus far away. And why motor gets picked up with somatosensation versus vision is not clear. Okay. The other thing that
is there some reason that M1 is between M2 and M3?
No, I mean this is we could shuffle the labels if that makes you happier, right? Okay. The other thing that comes out of this, Nietzsche had reanalyzed the C. elegans connectome, and the feature that comes out of this, one feature is the idea of hubs. Okay. And again, what comes out of this is the idea that there are a number of structures that, which are just bigger circles in this particular picture, which in a sense really act as hubs. Okay, so substantia niger reticulata is one. I don't think, again, the details aren't important here, and the details perhaps will change as we get better methods of doing projections. But you know, it seems that on every nervous system that's been studied in some amount of detail, you have this notion of hubs, of a few particularly strong areas, at least from the graph-theoretic way. Okay, so this is one thing that I came out of this. But again, you know, keep in mind, this is because, I would say, to its embarrassment, neuroscience has been very cortico-centric, okay? All this analysis is really at the level of forebrain. Okay, so that's sort of the state of the art in terms of analysis. So the other point I want to just bring up here is this idea of hierarchy. I'm just going to take, this is just out of work by, this is a review by Martin Duchenne and myself, but I think it establishes sort of a basic concept for all sensory motor systems. So computer scientists have this notion of nested loops, of a process, and then that process exists within another process, and that process exists within a third process, et cetera, et cetera. So the question is can one look at the architecture of nervous systems and ask if it naturally fits into this scheme? So just as a matter of making progress, we did this for the vibrissa system, again with some bias because we've been doing experiments there. So we're starting, this is the outside world, okay? What the rodent does, okay, for this near field view of the world is it's moving its nose and it's also sweeping the sea of hairs out in front of its face. So there are the muscles that move the hairs, and then there's the world, and then there are sensors. So the sensors are pressure sensors in little follicles that respond to interference with movement of the vibrissa within the world, okay? So the signals from the vibrissa will go through a brainstem ganglion and then go into a series of brainstem nuclei. Okay, the names in anatomy are illogical and hellacious. I'm not going to try to mention any names, okay? But the point is this. In one synapse, you go over from regions that in a classic sense have been identified as sensory regions because they're getting input from one synapse away from the outside world, and then you go over to the motor neurons, okay, which are then driving the muscles. So this is one synapse. Okay. Now, at the same time, however, there's quite a lot of feedback that goes on. I mean, there's feedback within the structure, which you would think of in terms of reflex, either in the spinal cord, one thinks of single synapse reflex, in the brainstem, one thinks of disynaptic reflex. But from the point of view of nested loops, signals will rise out of this area, go over to a region called the tectum or the superior colliculus. Two synapses later, they're back to these facial motor neurons. So you're replacing a single synapse at the level of the hindbrain with two synapses at the level of the midbrain, okay? Information will leave this primary brainstem nucleus, go up to the thalamic region, okay? From the thalamic, in the forebrain, from the thalamic region, go up into cortex, and then, depending exactly where in cortex it's processed, either one synapse later or three synapses later, will come back down to the trigeminus and over to the facial nucleus. Okay, so you replaced what's essentially zero synapse processing in here with a side loop, okay, which is three synapses. And more classically, input goes through thalamus, one synapse, into cortex, layer 4, layer 2, 3, layer 5, over into what's classically called motor cortex, okay? Another synapse or three synapses, and back down to the facial motor nucleus, okay? So there's what you're doing is you're constantly replacing what's a single synapse at the lowest level with synapses at higher and higher level. So this picture, even though I'm showing you this picture for the vibrissa system, which is unless some of you could do something very particular with your whiskers that I don't know about, nonetheless, is a general plan. It will hold for addition, hold for movement of the head instead of movement of the hairs, hold for vision, movement of the eyes, or combined movement of the head and the eyes, in addition for somatic sensation. So I really want to emphasize this idea of hierarchy that takes place during all processing. We'll just skip this. All right, so what's the alternate view? So it's, feed-forward layer networks are slowly taking over the world. It's a scary proposition, because one day you'll get run over by the self-driving car that isn't particularly trained on your own street. But it's a fair question to ask, why don't we ignore 90% of the synapses in the brain and ask how far we can get with just a totally feed-forward view, okay? I mean, first of all, on the one sense, one could take the previous picture and we could draw this in a largely feed-forward fashion, right? We could ignore these feedback pathways both within the brain itself and through the outside world, and most of the arrows seem to be going in the forward direction. But a somewhat serious effort was made in this direction now some 11-ish years ago out of Tommy Poggio's lab. So I think it's important to see both sides of the story. So what Poggio's lab did is they took the picture I showed you for somatosensory, for the vibrissus system, for the somatosensory system, I sort of stopped at one level of cortex, or two levels of cortex, secondary cortex. But in the visual system, and particularly in the macaque, in the monkey visual system, there's the complexity is much greater, and there's very many levels of visual processing, up to the point that you're in inferior temporal cortex, you're actually recognizing sort of essential features of faces, okay? So what Tommy Poggio did was take this sort of famous Van Essen diagram of the visual system and turn it into a multi-layer network, and at every layer in the network, take the known receptive field properties. Ask the question is, what feature in space, not space-time in this case, but just space, the neurons tend to respond to? And they put together a layered network. And they wanted the layered network to train. They trained this layered network to answer one question. Is there an animal in the picture? Okay, so the training set was lots of photographs with animals. Horses, cows, dogs, I mean, all of Noah's Ark of possible animals. And then they had the same, of course, in order to form the training set, right, they had one group of people have to score the pictures, and then they would take the pictures, use them in the network, and they would also then take naive viewers, right, flash a gray screen, did serious psychophysics, flash this picture that maybe has a cow in the corner, and then you had to, you know, push the lever to the right if it was with animal or without animal. So the shocking thing at the end of the day, okay, is there's actually a little animal out here, which you can't see in this picture, is that this is their layered network. These are people. This is close up. This is far away. I mean, details aside, the people and the network, as far as recognizing if there's an animal, okay, did about as well. Okay, details aside. So I think this is something that we have to, despite all the great anatomical evidence, okay, and the electrophysiological evidence for high connectivity and this constant flow of information. At least for, maybe this is way too simple a picture, but this is the only serious study that I know of. Okay, you do quite well with a layered network.
But so, this is only very short response.
Very short responses, yeah. Yeah, and I'm not saying that this neural network would get an A on, we're in the physics building, on QED, but it's still, no argument. Okay, but I can only sort of take what's in the literature and give a little bit of a review. Okay, so it'd be nice to know when these break down. That's basically your question.
But then machines can also multiply numbers very fast. I mean, way faster than I. So why should I be surprised by this?
Okay.
I gave up on my arithmetics a long time ago.
I can't talk, okay, but I felt at some point one needs to come to grips with a view, okay, with a sort of feed-forward view, okay, and that's why I'm bringing this up. Okay, it's not a view I subscribe to, but that's not the point. I mean, maybe in fact this is the bulk of the way the nervous system works and most of the feedback connections are really there for some, you know, plasticity issue. I mean, it's a fundamental question in the field.
Yeah. Sorry, David, everybody's giving you a hard time about this one.
I don't care. I mean, I have tenure.
Yeah. And it's not your work, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know how you're going to defend it. I can take a set of differential equations to describe a highly interconnected network and, you know, integrate them using an Euler scheme on a feed forward, on a machine that's programmed, I mean, which only goes forward, right?
Yeah.
Am I supposed to take seriously that the properties of the individual elements mimic the properties of real neurons? Is that why So the fact that there exists a machine with feed-forward architecture that reproduces human performance does not by itself seem to be particularly profound. The fact, if you're going to say that the properties of the elements in that machine are comparable to the properties of neurons, then I guess it gets more interesting, right? And so then you have to ask how seriously one should take that.
Okay, I guess I would take it seriously. I realize you just used threshold elements, but I mean, truth be told, I mean, very many neurons in your body are operating in sort of threshold linear fashion. We could have an argument on the side. So,
The top layers are radial basis functions. Not the usual properties of neurons. They're kind of abstract perceptive field. The first layers are more relevant to the visual, you know, receptive fields. And
okay, so you think I'm overplaying this a little bit?
No, I'm just addressing the question. That's all. I think it's not fair to say that all elements there are based on.
Okay, fair enough.
On what is known. It's fair enough. First layer, top layers are more.
Okay, Bill, so this is going to become a discussion for Wednesday wine, but...
But let me just, one more comment or question is, the question, the model, I mean, it's not that it can do the human performance, but why doesn't do better? In other words...
But it's trained on...
The training was not on human data. The training on the task, not on human performance. They didn't stop training when it got to human performance.
No. Oh, I mean, these are human. These are human scored pictures. So maybe this just gets back to the fact that a human could do as well as 50 milliseconds as a human could do in an arbitrarily long amount of time. But the pictures are relatively straightforward. What? You expected the machine to do better?
Look at the prime. I mean, you think that's the state of the art vision and performance on animals with not animals? Probably would be 100% would be animal.
Oh, I don't know how.
The human observers on a very rapid task, like physics task. Okay, and the model does it. But the question is, is it an accident that the model doesn't do better than you?
Okay, I don't know how to answer. Yeah, I don't know how to answer.
So when the pictures were scored, this was done based on long presentation.
It could go above. And the humans could have gone above. Yeah, well, either one. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to... This accomplished its role of getting everybody awake. Okay. Let me just... How are we doing on time? Okay, I'm going to not do everything here. So I wanted to accomplish two more things. One, I wanted to talk a little bit about the lessons from anatomy. And I thought before then it's worth just doing a little bit of an understanding of what the technological background is today. Okay, so I'm not going to be able to get through all of this, but let me just get a little bit of a flavor. Again, from having sort of entered neuroscience late, there seem to be these dark ages in neuroscience when all experiments on awake animals were done on anesthetized animals, which is a statement like saying you want to study your toaster with a plug pulled out of the wall. It was a rather absurd period, but I guess the good news is now, it's swung too far in the opposite direction, okay? But the modern lab is to have a behavior, and often a constrained behavior, okay? So you could monitor it, and then use the signals from that behavior as a reference for ongoing physiology, measured either optically or electrically or whatever. So just to give a little bit of a constraint, this is from B. Pileski, is modern training, the old training is, it's like a joke, someone's in their white lab coat trying to coax the animal what to do. The modern training is to have automation, is to really use your robotics and factory automation at its best, to have animals behaving. In this case, beast is having animals learn to press a lever for food. As a matter of fact, learn to press a lever in a certain sequence for food. You could train large numbers of animals in this direction. You could have purely psychophysical experiments. But the other thing that you could do, which is critical for some experiments, is that in a sense you could cut down the dimensionality of the behavioral space. So this is just motion of the animal's limbs at this moving a lever very early on in training. There's a huge amount of variability, very late in training. That variability has largely been quenched. Okay, I mean, this works in both directions. I mean, this can be used as a way just to follow individual neurons as they learn. Okay, the complaint in this direction is that if you measure from animals that are highly overtrained, in a sense, you've cut down the dimensionality of the task. So you, and of course, people see high degrees of correlation when they look at motor tasks. But the point is to think about how people are doing experiments, or suggest, if you're going to suggest to somebody how to do experiments, it's very reasonable to think of having tens, maybe even hundreds of animals co-trained, right? So you could really get some serious statistics about what's going on. And okay, so I'm just going to leave that. I want to give a little bit of a sense of recording. Recording, again, has moved very far in the direction of recording from many cells at once, but I think it's very important, both from as a theorist and experimentalist, just to remember that there is nothing better than putting a single electrode in a cell and recording intracellularly from that cell. I mean, not only are you getting synaptic inputs into that cell, which is kind of a window to the world, so you're really recording from a large area, but you also have control over that cell, so you can tell the nature of the synaptic input. So this is data from a colleague, Martin Duchenne, intracellular recording. We have vibrissa that are moving, so we have a reference signal for sweeping of the vibrissa. We have a reference signal for breathing. We have a reference signal actually for the animal sniffing. And again, because you can measure now behavior, okay, you could actually ask if the firing of a unit is tagged to a particular behavior. In this case, it could be vibrissa position versus breathing. This happens to be a unit that tracks very nicely whisking. Okay, and you could ask what phase it is relative to the whisking cycle. The other thing about being inside a cell is that you could fill that cell with a label. And if you fill that cell with a label, you could come back later on, okay, and you could understand something about the expression levels of that cell. Like you could ask, is it actually expressing a gene that tells it to make an excitatory neurotransmitter or an inhibitory neurotransmitter? So even though in one direction the field is going towards recording from many cells, in another direction, you really can get an extremely complete view about what's happening within a single cell. Yeah?
Where's the intracellular trace? Not on this figure.
It's in this figure.
There you are.
Okay, with somebody else's theory, I could, you know, I don't. Now you're striking close to my heart, okay? Okay. I mean, the point here was just to emphasize this, that you could use, a 40-year-old technique of injecting chloride through the electrode, and you could actually flip the sign of a synapse, which is, you know, chloride-based synapse, and this tells you something that the cell is getting an inhibitory input. So it's just a point I wanted to make, and you could also fill a cell, and you know, I recorded from this cell, and I know this cell sent a collateral some other place, and that's going to be the experiment I do next week.
Question? Is it in the future or the past?
It's both. I mean, if it was just poking a cell, you would say it's the past. But what makes this part of the future is that you could do your experiment, you could put a dye in the cell, you could use in situ hybridization, RNA scope, any number of techniques to see what message is being expressed by that cell. So you know its firing properties, you know its projections, and you know what it's expressing. You can also suck out the nucleus of that cell And then you could do sequencing on nuclear expression of
that
message.
You can do on populations.
So it's what?
That you can do on populations. You don't need a single. That you can do on a population of cells, not on a single cell.
Sequencing? You could do. I mean, you could do both. I mean, I would think it's very important today. If you're in a region which is heterogeneous, which one cell to the next is somewhat different, is you can relate the firing properties, the you know, in situ firing properties during behavior to the sequence for that particular cell.
Is there a method that could do it beyond single cell? That's what I'm asking. Who is going to invest in that's doing it in single cell?
Well, okay.
Cell calling.
Us. and this was our U19. We will measure from one cell, but we will measure goddamn everything from that cell. That was.
You choose the right cell, Jaime. Maybe it's interesting.
It's one extreme.
Depends which cell you study.
It's one extreme, but I think it's a very useful extreme. I mean, the other extreme. So let me show you. I mean, I have. We could argue. The other extreme is to say I'm going to record from many cells. Okay. But the problem in most techniques, when you say I'm going to record from many cells, is there's an issue of statistics, right? If I'm not actually in the cell itself, or I'm not patched onto the cell, I don't know with 100% certainty, okay, that I'm recording from one cell or two cells that just say or happen to be anti-correlated. And then I don't have the ability to do track tracing of that cell to know where it's projecting to, and I don't have the ability to know something about the expression level in that cell. So I think this is two extremes. So Tim Harris, a good colleague at Tenua, pushed these very, very high density electrodes. Okay, this is a wire about every 20 microns, this is the state of the art in hard electrode technology. There's floppy parts of the brain. Like the brainstem, so she at Austin, Texas, are pushing sort of floppy electrodes, but it's still not clear always how to get the floppy electrode into the brain. So you usually have a stiff wire. So somewhere along the line, you're punching a big hole. But this is another sort of technology with a high density of electrodes, and I think the state of the art is here. This is from Tim's NeuroPixel paper. It made The Economist. I mean, it's better than most of us. And what was particularly, I thought, beautiful about the quality of the data is you see the same cell actually contribute to many, very, very many electrodes. So sort of like, you almost sort of have a point spread function for an electrical signal in space, so you could get a very good localization of a single cell. Okay, but you don't know where the cell is projecting. It's only in a statistical sense that you believe it's one cell. So I think that's the difference, Chaim. So people look at both directions. I think as experimentalists, your lab may not do both techniques, but you have to be aware of both techniques and the limitations of both techniques. And the sorting of this is, I mean, typical best in the strongest sense of the expression of data. Okay, you should be wary of people who won't show you the waveforms for every cell that they're talking about in their papers.
What about the voltron?
What?
What about the voltron?
The what?
Voltron.
Volt?
Voltron.
What's that?
Developing in Germania.
Both sets of dye.
Which gives a special resolution of the neuron and a subtemporal resolution of 1 millisecond.
This is Casper's thing?
This is
with CASP. Okay, let me. Okay, no, but I just want to be very little. David, you have to be extremely careful about people having an unpublished paper or some crap in bioarchives and having something that's been out there for a while. Okay, so what? Okay, I'm just trying to do my best to give things that, at this point in time, many people believe in. Okay, how are we doing? 5 more minutes, okay. So the other view, to get back a little bit to the point Chaim raised, is how to record for many cells. Okay, so if our calculations are correct, you could, in principle, using very stiff material, which is diamond, using state-of-the-art line widths, which are down to around 15 nanometers. And you basically, Ohm's law is obeyed down to about 5 nanometers. Okay, get a dense enough array of electrodes that you could, in principle, be within 20 microns of every neuron in cortex and only fill up about 5% of the brain, which is about 25% of the extracellular space. So it's not so nuts down the line, okay, to have a high enough density of electrodes to really fill the brain. Okay, just doing sort of back of the envelope electrical engineering calculations. Okay. An alternative way not to record from every neuron, but to record from every neuron in a certain thickness of band, is not to look at the electrical activity per se, but to look at sort of a ghost of the electrical activity. So every time a neuron fires a spike, you open up a channel, so-called high voltage calcium channels, and a little bit of calcium comes into the cell. And this is not a membrane signal now, this is a signal throughout the cytoplasm of the cell. And a former, the late Roger Chen, sort of started this industry of making molecules that change their optical properties, okay, as you change the calcium concentration. And this has turned into kind of an industry, and an industry in the sense that you could have an optical field, and within that field, you could identify many individual somata, and within the somata, when there is not necessarily a single electrical spike, but maybe sort of a burst of electrical spikes, okay? You get a signal, if you look at the time base here, it's 20 seconds. The recovery time, depending on the dye you use, is anywhere from 100 milliseconds to a few seconds. Okay, and I think the modern end of this, and this, okay, this comes from our colleague, Karel Svoboda's lab. This is Nick Safrania's data. We're just sort of honing in the very large scale view. And now we're honing in on a couple of cells, and you could follow. You have the freedom to move around within the brain, okay? So that's what you gain, and you could actually then follow the activity of a number of cells. And the price for this, okay, again, is you don't know where the cells are necessarily connected to, at least in the short term, but you're taking a hit on the timing. Okay, 20 seconds. I mean, the fight's over. One animal has eaten the other animal and gone home, okay? Okay, so just to push this a little bit of how, adaptive optics that came from the physics community, from the astrophysics community, has sort of made its way into microscopy now to correct for many of the distortions that happen as the brain, as light propagates through the brain. And the extreme case now is to go, these are layer 5 cells, so now we're almost the full depth of mouse cortex, and sort of using tricks from adaptive optics, one can not only measure the firing properties of cells, but I showed you early on the synaptic inputs from Bobby Kasturi's reconstructions. You could actually look at the activity of different synaptic inputs in real time, okay? So you can't look at hundreds of these the way you can look at hundreds of cell bodies, but if you restrict your view and you sort of use the tools from astronomy, you could go very deep. Okay, I'm going to leave you with one last scientific thought, okay, and then we'll take a break. So where do all these techniques leave us as far as understanding synaptic connectivity? So I started at the beginning by talking about the hierarchy of the nervous system and the fact that regions are heavily interconnected. I didn't really say anything about what historical data record talks about the connectivity, but I did raise the question of neurons have on the order of 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 4 connections per cell, with one very special exception, which is the granule cells in the cerebellum, which have like 3 connections, okay? But then the question is, what are the strengths of these connections? And work that goes back to Alex Thompson in the mid-1990s, where in a slice preparation, right, a reduced preparation of the nervous system, she'd look at the distribution of connections, and what you'd see are some very strong connections and many very weak connections.
What is the white and the dark?
Okay, forget about the black. Okay, just look at the white. I mean, or look at the line. Okay, don't. Okay. Okay, so there's been a fair number of studies since that time, over the last decade, from different labs, the details of what different labs measure, but the gist is always the same. There are a few strong connections, there's many weak connections. There are a few strong connections, there's many weak connections. A few strong, many weak, a few strong, many weak. I mean,
actually, the Thompson data seem to point to a kind of bimodal distribution that seemed to imply that the previous.
Yes.
That we could forget about the weak.
Well,
No.
Okay. The Thompson data points to a bimodal distribution. Whether you can forget about the weak is the point. Okay, because the question is, if I look at the integral, this integral is larger. Okay, so there's the total vesicle release to weak connections is actually more than the total vesicle release to strong connections. And I realize
that hope is completely gone with the more modern data. There is no hint of bimodality.
Well, there's no hint of bimodalness. Okay.
Well, you're not claiming it's bimodal.
I didn't claim it's bimodal. That was Alex.
It's just to say that distribution is log normal.
I just wanted to say it's not a simple distribution.
So it's a log normal distribution, right?
Right.
So.
I'm not making any claims. I just did my best to do homework. Okay. And
in the spirit of your critical remarks about different experimental techniques, of order, how many observations actually go into these? I mean, some of these look like, you know, dozens. And as you noted, a single cell gets thousands of inputs.
Yeah. But your ask is, how biased are these measurements?
What is the size of the data?
How many cells are involved?
I mean, Alex Thompson's data had on the order of 50, 60 cells, if I remember right. That was data taken from layer 6.
In this case, you're measuring one connection.
How many synapses?
Well, okay, wait.
What you don't know
is if the strong ones are actually multiple synaptic contacts. I mean, if the difference here is one of multiple synaptic contacts. Is that the question?
Well, I guess I'd
Or do you think it's?
It seems like there are many questions. If the typical cell takes 3,000 inputs, and I measure the strength of a few dozen synapses, I'm worried that I don't see the tail. I'm worried that I might be biased. I'm worried that, I mean, I'm sort of nowhere near being reasonably sampled, right?
I agree with you. And I even agree with you for reasons you're not even thinking about, because you're very biased. You're very biased towards synapses that are close to where the patch electron is, which is the soma. Okay, and in this case,
or the experimental technique?
Not personally, okay. Experimental technique.
Well, you told me I was thinking about it for reasons that we're agreeing.
No, most of these experiments were done in slice, in the sense that the cell had the highest resistance it's going to have, because when the cell is active, on the one hand, there's active currents, but on the other hand, the fact that there's this barrage of synaptic background makes the cell leaky, so it makes it even more insensitive to what's happening in distal parts of the cell. So I agree, it's biased, okay? But I'm not sure, and by this thinking, right, what you'd like to, the perfect experiment would be to take the one cell and walk to every presynaptic partner of that cell and excite that presynaptic partner and look at the distribution of synapses and then repeat this on cells and animals. That's what would make most people happy. But I'm just sort of.
And why hasn't been done?
I think it's.
When you can identify spines and
Well, I mean, there is this. I mean, there is one person who's trying this. I think you were alluding to Casper at Geneva. I'm not saying that. I mean, that's a social question. I mean, you know, neuroscience flows. So this was a topic, and today every young person wants to measure decision making. Maybe in 3 years they'll get back to wanting to do this. Okay, that's an ethereal question that's beyond this data.
It's technically much better. One can have thousands of single connections.
I think you could fill a cell, so you know the postsynaptic cell, or just have a very sparse viral labeling, okay? And then you could take a class of presynaptic cells that themselves express a certain virus at their presynaptic ending, so you can know where to go, and you could do the experiment. And you actually could do it. And I think with good adaptive optics, you could get down to excitation volume, which is, you know, maybe about a third of a micron on edge. So it's a matter of willpower. The technology is there. Okay, it just hasn't been done. Okay, so, but
maybe the answer is already in your saying that it's a sociological question. That people don't think that they will get anything more interesting than this unimodal distribution.
Okay, but I don't know. All right, I got 1 minute.
In your adapted optics data, when you look at the spine sizes, do you see similar distribution?
Oh. Okay, so we did not go through different spines. I mean, that data I could look up. Most of that data is Kristen Harris, other people. That's a fair point. Okay, it's a good question. That's a good question that I could answer.
So
it should be answered. What?
Yeah, so we did that.
I do it this afternoon?
So you send me the data.
Okay.
Robert, we did that.
Yeah.
The distribution of individual spines Bhutan's is exponential.
So not that one.
No. And I don't know the cause for this, but the likely culprit is, as David said, two neurons have multiple contacts to have an EPSP of a few millivolts. Okay?
But so when you say exponential, it's for a single Bhutan.
That's right. But that's what the question was.
Yeah. And what are you measuring?
That's the size. Okay, so you can measure the volume of the spine head, and you can measure the area of the DSD. Both of those quantities are highly correlated with EPSP magnitude, and so that's how you get an exponential. And to answer the previous question, our data set of Song et al. Has several thousand such measurements, from which we were able to extract the log normal distribution.
Which one?
It's not here. Song.
I'm going to apologize.
David.
No, I know your data set. I didn't.
Okay. I didn't say anything. I'm just answering.
Okay. I was going to, because you talked about the fact that there tend to be more reverse connections you expect than chance in that paper, but I just sliced. Whatever. Okay. So, I'm out of time. So.